Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting here with Sarah McGilley, and we're across from Holly Crosby, who's coming to talk about Cedar Valley. Welcome, Holly.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Cedar Valley is a novel, and it backs up after Goodwood. It is set in a small town, and something happens.
Something amazing and intriguing.
Well, the problem is, the problem with a book like this, which... And we had a look at a couple of reviews to try and work out how people are actually phrasing stuff, because you don't want to reveal anything. Like, I almost feel like I don't want to reveal the opening. I want people to experience it.
I do, because I want to talk to Holly about it, but maybe not on the podcast.
How much of your story can we talk about in front of an audience?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose that's up to the people asking the questions, isn't it? I do understand... you know, with the back of the book, with what it says on the back of the book, obviously the publishers sort of left it pretty open-ended, which I was really pleased with, because I would like people to be surprised by certain elements of it, and hopefully it introduces people to some historical things that they hadn't heard of before. Although that won't be the case for everybody, but for some it definitely will, which is kind of nice.
And is it too spoilery to talk about the inspiration, the real case that might have...
Yeah, it's really up to you guys. I'm happy to talk about it.
Because I want to
talk about it. She's a spoiler queen, and I don't like someone giving me a book and telling me nothing about it, and I experience
exactly
as the writer.
Well, maybe people are more likely to listen to a podcast after they've read it. I would be more likely to listen to a podcast about a book after I'd read it, because I wouldn't want spoilers.
Well, this is a spoiler-free zone.
And without saying anything about what happens to the characters in the book...
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about, like, maybe, so the case of the Somerton Man?
Yes.
Which has always fascinated me. So when I realised, reading this book, that this was, like, a factor in the book, I was, like, overjoyed. can you tell us a little bit about, you know, maybe that case and the research that you did for Cedar Valley?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a case that's always fascinated me as well. I feel like it's a case that is very intriguing for anyone if they hear about it. And, of course, you know, residents of Adelaide and probably South Australia will be familiar with it more than people in other states. But in general, I think crime and mystery buffs, especially if you're interested in unsolved Australian mystery or crime, people will have heard of it. But it is a really old case now. It was from 1948. Should I explain what happened?
Yeah, I think so.
Well,
a man was found dead on Somerton Beach in Adelaide, in Glenelg, and to this day they still don't know who he was or what killed him, and it's a fantastic story which involves, you know, potential spy involvement because of the time it was in terms of the beginning of the Cold War and some really odd clues that kind of were discovered in the months after the body was discovered. The fact that he had no identifying objects on him, like a wallet or
labels
on his clothes, for example. So, yeah, it's really intriguing. And the more you get into it, the more, and it relates to a book of Persian poetry, and there's a code in the book and a phone number. And, you know, my book is set in 1993. There has been a lot of developments on the Somerton Man case since 1993 up until now in 2018, and it's still happening because there's a man at the University of Adelaide, a professor called Derek Abbott, who's really interested in the case and is trying to get the body exhumed. So he's been kind of battling that for quite some time, and also has his students trying to crack the code that they found in the book of poetry. So in terms of the research I did, Derek has a great online resource material. There's like a Wikipedia page that's attached to the university, and he's got a lot of primary and secondary source material just listed there. And there's a police officer called Jerry Feltus who was not a police officer involved in the case because he's not old enough, but he was a police officer who just had a lay kind of interest in it and has researched it really thoroughly and has written a self-published book, which I ordered from him via his internet site. And he posted to you with this little note saying, you know, can you please email me and tell me that it arrived safely? So I emailed him and I thought that was kind of cute.
I'm 100% buying that.
Yeah,
book.
The thing about Jerry's book is, and Jerry, if you're listening to this, you really need to put an index in the back of the book. that's my only criticism of Jerry's book. But it's just completely full of, you know, pretty much. I mean, every piece of information is in there, Great sections about how just the common Australian person tried to crack the code at the time, how newspapers printed it. Newspapers sort of asked people to help crack it, so people were just sending letters from all across Australia trying to crack this code, and then they got the military involved to crack it. You know, everybody's had a crack at cracking it,
and nobody has. It's seemingly uncrackable.
It's seemingly uncrackable, and some people think it's just, you know, the scrawlings of a madman or something. But I don't think that. I do think it probably is some kind of cipher, but
Perhaps there's meaning in it that you can just never know without knowing details of the man's life, which we don't know,
because such is life, isn't it?
Yeah. So did the first germ of inspiration for Cedar Valley come from that case? Or?
No, the first germ of inspiration came from Goodwood, because when I was writing Goodwood, I mentioned the town of Cedar Valley in passing in Goodwood, just to set up the sort of surrounding area in my own mind, and I had characters that were either from that town or visited that town. In my mind, I kind of built this real region around the New South Wales South Coast area, and Cedar Valley was part of that region. And when I finished Goodwood, I just knew that I really loved that region still and wanted to work in it still. But I did want to leave Goodwood where it was and kind of have those stories a bit suspended. So I went a year forward and I went to Cedar Valley. And there are, you know, people who have just read Goodwood like last week will notice some characters that do pop up in this, but they're probably people that nobody would necessarily expect to pop up again. But it was really Benny's story where the book started, and so she's the in some ways the main character of this book, and I had her arriving in the town. I really wanted to tell the story from the third person perspective, and there's three different characters that's told from their kind of perspective, but in the third person, which is Benny and a police officer and Cora, who runs the antique shop. But I really wanted Benny to enter as a stranger, because it kind of allowed me to, as a city person, kind of channel that experience of myself being in small towns through her, whereas in Goodwood, Jean is a very much an inhabitant of that town. So I kind of wanted that slightly different perspective. And I was really interested in just this notion of motherhood and loss and memory and kind of family drama.
I love the way that you've got a mother with a life, like that sense of children have of, we have an idea of our mother, we have an idea of our father, we see them through that little prism for a long time, and then as you get older and as you start talking to them about their life, and you start realizing, oh, you did stuff long before I was around, and you did all this. I love that unpacking of somebody, and this was a kind of
or even just the idea that not every mother, you know, like, I mean, for Benny, the experience would be more never knowing. Like, so not every mother stays, and not every mother does the thing that is expected when you have a child. Like, sometimes they're drawn away.
Because there is a kind of there's an assumption in so much storytelling around those relationships, and we get so much of the same kind of telling.
I found like Vivian to be a really interesting character. There's so much in this book that just you can sense the connections, but it just takes a while to come into focus, and then when it does, it's so clever. Like, I just
is that a plan? Or is that something you're scoping out? To do that in that way?
Is what the plan to...
Well, the way things come together, the way things, like, to... Because you don't get what's happening, and then you do. Like, you sort of...
Yeah, I... In my mind, I had an idea of where I was going with this one more than I had an idea where I was going with Goodwood, but I didn't really know how to get there so much. So I do work very instinctively in terms of how much I want to give at certain points. So in terms of Benny, when she arrives at the town, the reason she goes to Cedar Valley is that her mum's old kind of old best friend lives in the town and has offered Benny this empty house in the township that she could stay in, because this woman, Odette, lives up in the mountain. And so in terms of their interaction and their conversations and what they were going to say about Vivian, because in my mind Vivian... The relationship between Vivian and Benny is a kind of almost a central mystery of the book, and then this more explicit mystery story of this man who arrives in the town in this suit for me, it was kind of fun to have them go alongside each other because it's interesting to me which one is more interesting to readers because I found them both equally compelling but for entirely different reasons. Like, I love doing the police procedural, even though it's kind of almost like a slapstick police procedural in some senses, and I really enjoyed subverting that in a kind of comic, really dry Australian way. But
I think they balance each other out really
well.
Yeah,
I hope so because I felt like there's a lot of sadness in Benny's story. But the thing about the Somerton Man, and there's even a character in the book that talks about the Somerton Man in this way, is that as far as although we have a man dead, and of course that's a very sad thing in itself, but she says it's just so kind of fun in terms of our mysteries.
And that really comes through in the book how the effect on the town of this, I mean, again, like, of an event, like the way that it sort of brings people together, and it's not even about the thing that happened, it's kind of about...
Yeah, I think that what I didn't want to do was present the town with something horrific that couldn't be interpreted in any other way than horrific. I wanted something that people could react to in different ways. Like, some people might find the incident that happens in this book just kind of curious and weird, and other people might find it really heartbreaking because it highlights things about their own lives, or other people might just actually not care and they don't need to care. Whereas I felt like if I introduced something that was just shocking and horrible, you kind of have to have everyone going through the same kind of thing. And although, of course, that's not true, everybody goes through a different thing anyway, but it's more difficult to just draw out the differences in people's responses to something that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
And also potentially sad, or potentially traumatic, or potentially, you know, just fun, I guess, for some people who are trying to figure it out.
Well, yeah, because it kind of mirrors the world's treatment of the Somerton Man. Like, people are so fascinated by that, and everyone kind of makes it about themselves in a little way in their own, like...
Of course. Yeah. And I think the one thing, the main thing about the Somerton Man that has been lost is the Somerton Man himself. I mean, like, even though the whole quest is to try and discover who he is, it's almost more fun not knowing. I think that's why it is so enduring, is because we don't know. And to me, I wanted this book to be about that nature of the impossibility of knowing anything.
Yeah.
You know, because Benny obviously has this quest to really to know her mother, and Odette, I think, had a similar quest for understanding in her own life about what's happened to her, about Vivian, a lot of the different characters in their book are struggling to either understand themselves or trying to understand a situation or you know, another person. And for me, it's sort of okay, that's the nature of life.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted things that I could explore that particular theme.
There's a real bittersweet beauty in those ideas that comes through in the book, and balanced really nicely with all the idiosyncratic characters. And it's a gentle, beautiful book with a mystery and some sadness. But I mean, you've basically just done it. You've done what was so great about Goodwood again. And like, I wonder how many more towns do you have in your head? Like, will we go back to Goodwood or Cedar Valley again, or is there another?
No, I don't think so, but I'm not quite sure. I mean, there is a town that's mentioned in both the books a lot, which is Clark, which is a regional kind of centre, but it's like, it's not a particularly romantic place. I mean, the thing that about Goodwood and Cedar Valley as well, and I base Cedar Valley really heavily on Braidwood in New South Wales. But these are gorgeous towns. You know, these are towns that even if you think it's a dead-end kind of place and you're dying to get out, you kind of can't deny the beauty of these towns, whereas Clark is described by several people as being one of those much more characterless regional centres that we all know so well. But I am kind of interested in exploring that, but it's too soon for me to know where I want to go with the next one.
So I was born in 1972, Benny's born in 1972, and I lived through 1993. And it's like for me, whenever I'm always surprised at how far away 1993 is getting from my present. It was wonderful to get all those, because I just don't think about it. The internet came in, put a big wall between then and now. And I just loved having little tiny bits come back to me. Because one of the things with this, when I was reading, I kept drifting off into memories of my time in the early 90s because of things that triggered me. in the book. And we were talking about it earlier. Why would you go through so much trouble of writing a book and then having all this research to do? Or is it just stuff that just flies?
Is it hard to get back into a mindset of 1993? Like, how much do you have to be careful of
anachronisms?
I think it came kind of naturally to me in both books. I think just because I was in 1992 and 93, I was in year 8 and year 9, respectively. And, yeah, it wasn't hard for me to kind of remember that time. Plus, I really like to set stuff when the flow of information is just a little slower.
Mm-hmm.
I just think you get a lot more sort of interaction with characters where conversations are a lot more important, face-to-face conversations are a lot more important. And I think with a small town setting, it kind of doubles up with that, you know, the kind of connections that you get in a small town, the constraints of small town living is kind of echoed in the way that people communicated in a slower way as well, pre-internet. And so that space to me is a really nice way to tell a story. There's something kind of weirdly wholesome about it. Yeah. And I think there's something quite cozy about it, which is something I really am aiming for in terms of the tone of these books, because especially a lot of mystery books have a very kind of cold, bare tone. But I want the tone of these books to be quite cozy and warm. And in that sense, I feel like it's kind of, it's okay to delve into sort of more difficult topics on occasion, because it doesn't make you kind of want to run away from the world. It's almost like the world of the book makes those discussions and those topics.
Someone's holding your hand as you go into the darkness.
Well, a little.
A nostalgic bubble of protection.
Maybe. I hope so. Well, we were just talking about In Cold Blood before we started this podcast. Yeah. And the thing I love about the book is the tone of that book, I think, is pretty incredible considering the subject matter, which is gruesome. But it's very funny and light as a book to read, which is, you feel kind of dirty, but it's...
So what are the books that that influenced your decision in writing in this way? Or is it you just went, I'm interested in these kind of subjects, but I don't want the darkness. I don't want to
believe the books that influence I'm certainly you. Influenced by writers that I really love and that I feel do the same thing. I mean, I think for me there's a lot of American writers that have the sort of, the books that were just really formative for me, because books that when I was, you know, in my teens or my 20s, that just really, for whatever reason, really spoke to me. And to this day, there's a certain type of book that I know that I'm very drawn to. So whether that's, in more recent times, White Houses by Amy Bloom, I think is just a fantastic, book in terms of just incredible writing and tone. And or Elizabeth Strout's books I just love. I think she's just a wonderful writer. American writers like Anne Tyler, I really admire. But when I was younger, I guess people like Richard Yates, who Revolutionary Road and Easter Parade are two of my favourite books, and he really manages to tell these really intense, quite dark stories, but they just sort of skip along, you know, and I just really admire that. People like Carson McCullers, I guess, is...
So people who are taking on really big issues but not making it, like when you were talking before about crime, that kind of it's like crime porn or
tragedy porn.
Yeah, tragedy porn or violence porn or all these sort of things, where that comes, it's kind of creepy and disgusting to kind of go down that path. And then but there are issues within those kind of books that you want to sort of talk about, but you don't want to exploit it in any way.
I mean, I'm not saying I don't read crime books like that and kind of...
I definitely do.
our crime expert over here.
I'm not as so interested to explore that myself. For me, I'm more interested in... I guess my main interest would be kind of human connection and what makes us all similar. That's a really... big concern of mine and something I think about a lot, just in terms of my own social group or family or friends. Like, I think if we can bring out the kind of common humanity in people, then I think this is the way that we solve a lot of problems. And for me in this book, it's not like I've really deliberately set out to do this in fiction, but I think my worldview is is that, so I kind of can't help myself. But with this book, you know, Benny and Cora and Simmons are these three characters, and Simmons is this kind of asshole policeman, and Cora is this really irritating lady that runs the antique store, and Benny, like our young gorgeous hero. But they're so similar. You know, Cora is so similar to Benny, and Benny's so repelled by her, but only in the ways that she recognizes herself. And Cora to me is so human. I loved her. Like I found, she kind of broke my heart, because she's sort of excruciating, but she's also so self-reflective, and she's so self-critical and self-questioning. And I kind of feel like excruciating behavior is kind of okay if you're those other things as well, even just in private. And I just wanted to kind of bring out, even just subtly, the way that these three people are actually really similar, even though we would look at them and be so either attracted or repelled. Mm-hmm. And it's obvious where me as an author is sitting in terms of being attracted and repelled with the characters, but and you do that as an author, but I also tried very hard to say, yes, Simmons is an asshole, but like he's also like he's a broken man, and he's really kind of doing his best.
Yeah.
And I really felt for him.
Yeah, I have a strong attraction to books that will do that. They will remind us of the 360-degree nature of these of people, that you get one face and then they'll go home to their family and they'll have another face for them, and then another face for their best friend, or you know. And so we sort of walk away with this, oh, I can't believe she said that to me.
And even if someone's showing everyone the same face, you just never really know.
Yeah, yeah.
You never really know what's going on underneath.
Yeah, you never know what's happened to people, and you never know what they're trying to, you know, how they're trying to cope inside or whatever. Mm. So I feel like that's something that's important to remember.
I think there's a lot of love for the characters within the book, and it makes them, you just do fall for these people. They're flawed and interesting and annoying and, like, and lovable. Like,
yeah, I hope so.
Holly, thank you so much for coming and talking about Cedar Valley. And you know, we expected to have the success of Goodwood, which was really wonderfully successful for a debut author. And you know, we've got this down as one of our big hits for the coming Christmas period. So we'll be pushing it for you everywhere we go.
Oh, lovely.
We're going to become a loudspeaker for Holocaust. Thank you so much for coming to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can get hold of both books by Holly Fosby at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.